in your district.
Joined today by Senator Dyson.
Oh.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson.
Boy.
Senator Bundy, Senator Stevens. Senator Wilkins is not able to be here with us today because of the currents in Fairbanks that he felt that he needed to attend. We will be pulling from today's agenda Senate Bill 203, if you're here for that bill, because there are some fiscal notes and additional information that is not yet ready. Be reminded that cell phones and pagers need to be tended, and we will change the order, and we will begin with Senate Bill 305, then go to 295, then to 299, only because we have someone on teleconference that has a limited time frame and wants to testify on those two bills. Anyone wishes to testify on any of the bills before us today, be sure that you've signed in so that we have your name. And okay, Joe, are you ready to begin on Senate Bill 305, which is the asserting state title to submerged land? It's an ominous title.
Good morning. Madam Chairwoman, for the record, my name is Joe Balash, staff to Senator Terrio. Senate Bill 305 is, as you stated in the title, an act relating to state ownership of submerged lands. In 1959, with the limited exception of federally withdrawn lands, Alaska received, under the Equal Footing Doctrine, title to all submerged lands under state navigable waters and marine waters out to 3 miles. Unfortunately, the federal government has been slow to concede any of these navigability determinations necessary for title acquisition. And since Alaska entered the Union, the federal courts have determined fewer than 20 rivers navigable. Unless the state is proactive in asserting its claims, it stands to lose up to 60 million acres of its statehood entitlement. In some cases, the federal government has used every possible legal tactic under the Federal Quiet Title Act to impede the state's assertion of ownership. The Black, Candig, and Nation Rivers in Northeast Alaska are examples. These three rivers clearly meet the criteria established by the federal courts for determining navigability in Alaska. Although no one contested the state's claim that these streams met the federal criteria, this case took 9 years and millions of state and federal dollars to litigate. Eventually, the state won 2 of the 3 cases, and the third was resolved by a federal recordable disclaimer of interest filing in 2003. In addition, prior to 1989, the federal government, BLM in particular, applied incorrect standards to determine navigability and may have mistakenly conveyed state-owned land to native corporations, clouding the title to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of acres. This is a critical topic as Congress considers a deadline for completing the land selection and conveyance processes, targeting 2009 in most accounts, for that to conclude. Contributing to the problem is the lack of a reasonable and efficient way for the state to secure title to its submerged lands. Senate Bill 305 takes 3 steps to begin the process of identifying state claims. First, Senate Bill 305 provides notice to all parties that the state is laying claim to all submerged lands, except those withdrawn at the time of statehood, that meet the standards and criteria established in the Submerged Lands Act and in various federal court decisions. Second, it provides authority for state agencies to identify, in accordance with the appropriate federal and state laws, which water bodies the state claims is navigable and non-navigable. This will help the state clarify criteria for identifying navigable waters, address conflicts involving clouded titles due to inaccurate conveyances from BLM, and more clearly delineate its title claims. Third, the bill directs the Department of Natural Resources to give notice to all private property owners, including native corporations created under ANCSA, that may have received title to lands that could have erroneously included state submerged lands in their conveyances. This is critical to resolve future problems regarding mineral development, gravel extraction, access, and other related legal land uses. And this legislation is only 1 step for the state to eventually resolve the title disputes over its submerged lands and deals only with the issue of state title. It does not address conflicts over federal fish and wildlife management in state waters created by Federal Reserve water rights claims. This is primarily an issue where federal agencies have used incorrect definitions and means of conveying title to primarily the native corporations. And this is just an assertion of the state's claims and an effort to make sure that we've put on record as a body that we don't concede any of our title to anybody.
Is there implication if we concede title to one group that we might also be forced to concede title similarly if it were to go to other, be conveyed incorrectly?
Madam Chairman, the real question that sort of is nagging at the heart of this issue is that a water body has to have been considered navigable at the time of statehood. The knowledge, the files, the criteria upon which that's all based in order to stake that claim is getting old. The people who know about particular bodies of water are soon to be passing, and we will lose the ability to regain that knowledge and reclaim that title in a court or in front of a federal agency if that's what it takes. And so we don't want to go through a period of time here where all of those people pass, all of those files become aged to the point where they're no longer useful, and a court looks back and if the state in the future tries to lay claim to that title, the courts may say, well, you didn't really care about it for the last 45 years, why do you care about it now? That's a simplification, of course, but that is the concern.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Belash, you made a comment that there were incorrect standards being used that were put in place by the BLM. Is there a definition for that, or is this just a difference of opinion as to what navigable waters are?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, they did use incorrect definitions. The courts have delineated what a navigable water body is, and there were conveyances made in prior to 89, before some of that case law came out, that would indicate that there probably are pieces of the state's title that have been conveyed to the native corporations incorrectly. I might add that as we're approaching sort of this 2009 date where we want to complete the conveyance processes, each of the native corporations were given a certain acreage allotment, and any conveyance that was made to them incorrectly counted against that total acreage. If the state reclaims that title, that acreage is backed out against the allotment and would then free up additional selections for the corporations to make in the uplands or in other parts of the state.
So the net outcome is that the native corporations are not going to be happy with this legislation.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't think that's the case. They may wind up being able to select more acreage upland. The one scenario that may cause some concern or conflict might be if there are submerged lands that have been conveyed to them that they do not wish to give up. We have been in communication with at least one corporation, Sea Alaska, who's done a review, and they are working hard to try and figure out why they might not like this bill. So far, they've not come back to us with anything concrete.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Any other questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to our relationship on this issue with the federal government. It seems to me that history has shown, as you stated, that the federal government is dragging their feet in the conveying of these lands, submerged lands, and the avenue that we've had in the past is to take legal action, which costed millions of dollars. In the bill, you say you're going to be identifying state submerged lands, but if the federal government does not change its position, is it the assumption that the way that we as a state will get title to these submerged lands is through litigation?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's numerous courses that may be taken now and in the future. Currently, the Department of Interior, BLM, are working with the state on the recordable disclaimer of interest process. We're currently going through a number of cases right now. I believe Tina Cunning is available online from the Department of Fish and Game. She can speak to the current efforts. But one of the real problems we have is if we go to litigate under the Federal Quiet Title Act, it's very difficult, time-consuming, and will take an extraordinary amount of time. So one of the things that we're hoping can come about is in the next piece of legislation you'll be considering is the creation of a state-federal Nav Waters Commission where this can be done in an expedited manner. But that sort of gets off on another rabbit trail. There are options available to us that we can work with the feds to try and speed up this process, but this is sort of the very first step to make sure that we're making it plain to future courts and future federal agencies that this is what we intend to stake claim to.
The follow-up question, I guess, is thank you, Madam Chair, is that the Native corporations and the state have targeted 2009 as the deadline. What do you anticipate the identification of all state lands, submerged lands, to be identified by that date as well?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we are hopeful that a large number of these lands can be identified by them. Currently, the discussions underway in Congress don't include the submerged lands aspect in this conveyance process that they're currently discussing. However, the Nav Waters Commission that will be spoken to later today, legislation has been in front of the Congress previously. We hope that can be an option sooner rather than later. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions? I know we have on the teleconference four people, Dick Milius, Joanne Grace, Ron Somerville, and Tina Cunning. Looks like here they're all for answers only, but let me ask if any of them have any testimony. Dick Milius?
Madam Chairman, this is Dick Myers. I'm the Deputy Director of the DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and I'm just here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dick. If you'll stand by, if we have any, we'll get to you. Joanne Grace?
Me, Joanne Grace from the Department of Law. I also am just standing by for questions, Madam Chair, but if it's possible, I would like to clarify one point.
Right ahead.
I thought that Senator Hoffman was asking some very important questions, and I just wanted to add to the answers that he was given. The title to the lands underlying navigable waters passed to the state at statehood automatically. And the problem here is identifying what belongs to the state and what doesn't. So when BLM was applying incorrect standards before 1989, it may have purported to convey some submerged lands to Native corporations, but the United States did not actually have title to convey. So in other words, BLM may have said to Native corporations, we think this waterway is non-navigable, and we are conveying it to you, and we are charging you acreage for that land. But if, in fact, the waterway was not navigable, then BLM did not actually convey that title to the Native corporations because it didn't have title to convey. So the concern for Native corporations is that they are being charged for acreage for land that they didn't actually receive. And if the conveyances are all completed by 2009, then Native corporations are going to lose the opportunity to go back to BLM and say, you purported to convey the submerged land to us when you were using incorrect standards. We We would like you to go back and reconsider using the correct standards so that we can be credited with the acreage that we should have gotten for those submerged lands.
Thank you, Joanne. Senator Hoffman has a question.
Well, just a statement, I guess. The corporations that I'm familiar with have over-selections. They've made over-selections, so the assertion that they will be losing land may not be exactly true. It depends on how large their over-selections are. So I just want to do, you know, I know that the corporation that I sit on, they have over-selected in many cases well above 10%. So if in the future unless those lands are reconciled and the over-selections are reduced by 2009, I would say that many of the corporations will still get their lands. Thank you.
If there was a wrongful conveyance, would there not be a cloud on the title?
Well, there'll be a cloud on the title, and then if it's taken away from them, they've made over-selections. That's what I'm saying. So if you're, say, if you're entitled to 100 acres, but you filed on 110 acres, and some of them are taken away, then you look at your over-selections to get you into compliance with what your lands are allotted to you.
I got it. Yeah. Are there other questions? Ron Somerville, did you wish to testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Ron Somerville. I'm a resource consultant to both the House and Senate majority. I'm really primarily on for answering questions. If I may, just add a little bit to Joanne's statement to make it clear that when discussing the drafting of the SB 305 and SB 295, one of the issues revolved around exactly what Senator Hoffman is talking about. Only the corporations can request a clarification on these on the navigability issues from BLM. The state cannot do that. So the encouragement here as part of this is, in fact, to get that process going if the villages want to do that.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Ron?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Tina Cunningham?
I don't believe I have anything to add at this point. There have been a couple corporations that are closer to their final entitlement numbers than the corporations Senator Hoffman is referring to. And in one case, one of the corporations at our urging did go back and ask BLM to re-review some of the waters and in fact found them to be incorrectly included in the conveyances. So for some of the corporations, this has been a benefit to add additional upland acreage.
Thank you. Other questions for Tina?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the room who wishes to testify? Are there questions for Joe? I know on the last page, line 7 there, no native corporations within 180 days after the effective date of this act. He's talking, is that 180 days a reasonable time frame and notification on that? Sometimes we get very ambitious with our time frames. I just wanted to be sure that that's an acceptable time frame in order to do notification.
Through the chair, to the chair. I believe Dick Miles can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a generic notification to be sent out to potential landowners who may have been wrongly conveyed lands. Mm-hmm. This language was developed in consultation with the state agencies, and if that is a number that they are comfortable with, I believe it would not have been, I'm sorry, if they were not comfortable with this time frame, mm-hmm. they would have alerted us at that time.
Okay, so this doesn't require them to delineate piece by piece land, section, river, or whatever. It's just a generic notification.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and then the real drop-dead date is 2009, which I assume is 50 years after statehood. Is that the...
Madam Chair, the 2009 date has been used. That's the date being targeted by our congressional delegation, the governor's office. But the legislation in Congress to actually finish that task has not been passed, as I understand it.
Other questions? Will the committee?
Move it.
Would you like to make the motion?
Thought I just did. Madam Chair, I move that we move SB 305 out of committee with official recommendations.
And accompany fiscal note. Is there objection? Without objection, Senate Bill 305 moves out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note. Thank you, Joe. Senate Bill 295, Extending Navigable Waters Commission. I think Zach is going to join us today to talk about this. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Zach Warwick, staff to Senator Terrio. Senate Bill 295, unlike 305, is a little more straightforward and simple. In 2002, the Alaska State Legislature created a joint state federal navigable waters commission, made up of seven state and seven federal members, to create a working group tasked with the following three objectives. First, to expedite the process of acquiring legitimate title to the state's submerged lands. And second, to determine which bodies of water are navigable or non-navigable. And third, to provide recommendations to the state and federal government concerning ways to improve the process of making navigability determinations and ways to quiet title to the state's submerged lands fairly and expeditiously. Basically, it's trying to create some consensus between the state and federal government and kind of accompany Senate Bill 305 in that. Unfortunately, after the state legislation passed in 2002, the federal legislation did not succeed in passing. With that, the joint Navigable Waters Commission, their members were never appointed. All this legislation does is add an additional 2 years in the hopes that we can convince our Alaska delegation in D.C. to introduce and pass legislation creating and authorizing the federal portion of this Navigable Waters Commission. And with that, I'm available for any questions.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I notice it has a zero fiscal note, but I assume if there was ever federal authorization to put this together, then there would be a fiscal impact.
Through the Chair, Senator Bundy, it does have an indeterminate fiscal note, and that is our understanding as well, that if the federal side of this legislation were passed, then there would be a fiscal impact. And I think it ranges in let's say, $180,000 to $200,000.
Thank you.
Dan Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess with your last statement, you say that we are trying to get the congressional delegation to look at passage of this joint commission. Then why aren't we asking that? Why don't we have a resolution stating that instead of merely passing this legislation, which extends the term of the commission? You know, it doesn't seem to be saying what you are testifying before us.
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Seekins has a resolution that addresses some of this. It has already passed the Senate, I believe. It's in Senate rules right now and will be addressed on the floor. The federal side of the legislation did, I guess, receive a hearing in 2002, I believe. It received one hearing. It didn't go anywhere. I think there have been discussions with our delegation in D.C. to introduce something, and I'm sure there will be some ongoing discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's just my question.
Are there other questions? So this is just extending the termination date of something we've authorized.
Yes.
And are requesting the federal government to join us in joining forces.
That's correct.
Dick Milius, did you have any testimony you wanted to give on this?
Madam Chairman, this is Dick Milius, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Now, since I will just, would like to add to Mr. Warwick's comments there that we have an indeterminate fiscal note with the understanding that we would not proceed with establishing the state commission at this time until the federal commission was established. And at that time, we would envision the need for funding, although that would probably be dependent on how much funding the federal government provides for the commission.
I would ask any of the others who had signed up on 305 if they have any comments on 295.
To the chair, this is Ron Somerville, and I can answer questions if there are any. I think that did a pretty good job of outlining, and SDR 27 does deal, as he said, with a request that the federal government participate in both the commission process, continue with a recordable disclaimer, as well as provide amendments to the Quiet Title Act that will allow for the state to resolve some title disputes with the federal government more rapidly in federal court.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Is anyone in the audience who wish to testify? No. It's fine with me if this goes ahead and goes out of committee. Senator Dyson, would you like to move the bill from committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that SB 295 be moved out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying, I think, zero fiscal note.
The objections. Senate Bill 295 moves from committee with individual recommendations and indeterminate fiscal note. Thank you. Thank you for all who stayed around to testify. We do have the bill that was before us, SB 194. Yeah, Doug is still here, which has come back, and you have the CS for 194 before you. As you recall, we haven't gotten before us because distilled spirits had not been included with the original wine and champagne, and we had the conversation about beer so that we don't come back again. Is there anything else we need to...
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that pretty much summarizes the intent of the CS. As we talked on Friday, for the purposes of not having to come back to the committee year after year and add additional forms of alcoholic beverages, we thought it would be a good idea to put a CS forward that had beer in it. And for the record, my name is Doug Letch, staff for Senator Gary Stevens. For the purposes...
Just a minute, please. Can I get a motion to have the CS before us for purposes of discussion? Senator Stevens?
Madam Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 194 / D, Lauterbach 22704.
Objection. We're discussing the version D of 194. Go ahead, Doug, if you have any further information.
For the purposes of the CS, I did talk to Doug Griffin at the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and beer in the language of ABC would also include those other forms of malt beverages that you see today, the things like hard lemonades and iced teas and whatnot. They would fall in under that category. And we chose, we've already had a question on why 40 ounces of beer as a number in there, and Mr. Griffin suggested that would be an appropriate number for a floral bouquet or something that somebody would be delivering, would be one of those large bottles of beer or perhaps a sampling of beer inside a floral basket. So we didn't want to get too much into the quantity of, you know, somebody going to deliver a 12-pack or whatever, but we would be amenable. Exactly. We would be amenable to changing the ounce total without any problem.
Doug, for the record, they need you to identify yourself again,
sure.
Please. Your
yes.
Name and who you represent.
For the record, my name is Doug Letch. I'm a staff to Senator Gary Stevens, District R.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Huffman.
So that equates to three bottles of beer.
Yeah, it's 40, through the chair, Senator Huffman. It would either be one of the large bottles of beer or a few samples of beer. And Again, we were thinking of floral arrangements and not supplying a cater to a cruise ship or something.
And the since we're talking about quantities, what's the definition of a bottle of distilled spirits? If there's no definition, they can get the smaller pints or fifths or half gallons.
Through the chair, I believe we'd leave that to the regulatory powers of the ABC. They've suggested that they, in fact, on the ounces of beer, if you'd like to change that, they suggested that it would be appropriate for them to, and leave that blank, that they could develop language within the regulatory powers to do that as well.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson?
Well, thank you. Just to comment, with my responsibilities with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, we have been working on a project to get all the cruise ships to use West Coast products, including wine and beer and so on, get them to buy local. So it won't affect this bill, but hopefully we'll get some excellent products, including foods, on their menus.
Thank you. Are there any other questions about this bill, which we are hearing for the second time? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the CS? Will the committee?
Madam Chairman, I'll move committee substitute Senate Bill 194 / D from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. There being no objection, Senate Bill 194 is moved from committee with individual recommendations and coming zero fiscal notes. That brings us to Senate Bill 299. Senator Bundy, are you going to be presenting today?
With my able right hand, Jane Alberts, if you're ready for a motion.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to invite Jane to the table for questions that have details that may escape me. But basically, what this is an attempt to deal with some creativity, I guess, among those who would bounce checks. Current law says that a person who writes a bad check to a business, the business can collect up to $25 for the expense of having to deal with a bad check. It has come to my attention that there are those that said, okay, document that it cost you that $25. And that, of course, cost a good bit more than $25 to run this accounting procedure. What this bill would do is simply say there is a $30 penalty for writing a bad check and remove the legal requirement for the documentation of that cost.
Because current statute does have a reference to cost incurred by the plaintiff up to a maximum of 25, and with the court decision that overturned some collections, made it a little more difficult. Jane, do you want to go ahead and explain some more?
For the record, my name is Jane Alberts. I'm the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee aide for Senator Bundy. As Senator Bundy had stated, we're just trying to clarify and put in statute a set fee for a bounced or insufficient check. The flat fee would make tracking and follow-up on bad checks less cumbersome for businesses by eliminating the paperwork. There were some statistics that came out in our last meeting, which might be of interest to you. 15% of bad checks written are by innocent customers who just are unaware of their fund level at the time, and within a day or after a phone call, they make good on their checks. 40% of bad checks are written by chronic bad check writers, and they often take over 90 days to collect. which is considerable amount of time and effort on a business. And 45% of bad checks written are never recovered by affected businesses.
Say that percentage again, 45%?
45% of the bad checks are not recovered. That was a statistic that was came out in our last meeting. This bill would instill a clear deterrent to writing a bad check. Some of the fallout that is predicted would be that some businesses would just not accept checks as a form of payment any longer because of the hassle of collection, which, you know, reduces the options for people who are trying to live their lives without credit cards and debit cards and so forth. And as you can see in your packets, this bill is widely supported by Alaska businesses. It is my understanding it's been 18 years, I think, since this fee has changed. And I believe that we have Scott King from Cornerstone Credit that might be online with some more facts and figures on this.
If the members haven't seen the handout on the service fees for return checks for all the various states, it's very interesting how their balance is out, and $30 seems to be the top, and so would be right in there with most of the other states. Are there any questions for Jane or for Senator Bundy? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Is there anybody that's opposed to the legislation?
Not that we've heard of so far. I have not received one letter.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Jill Jekyll is online. It's Spinard Building Supplies. Jill, would you give your introduce yourself and say who you represent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jill Jekyll, and I'm the legal assistant at Spinard Builder Supply. And I would just like to testify in support of this bill because of the figures that were read off earlier and the fact that businesses do lose a lot of money when the profit of a cash sale is dramatically reduced by 90 days to get payment or to never get payment.
I had received an inquiry during the summer from a constituent concerning the collection on these people who, and the trouble when they choose not to come forward. Have you had any luck in, do you go to small claims court, or do you follow through, or what do you do on those who just refuse to make restitution or make it good? Do you have a policy there that you can share with us?
Yes, on the larger checks that we handle here, we do go for the civil penalties and the small claims cases, and if we are lucky enough to locate the person who wrote the check and get them served, we do get a judgment and collect from their permanent fund dividend check if they are applying for that. It's trickier than it is with someone who's filled out an application because you don't have the benefit of knowing the necessary information.
Mm-hmm. But there's also an intent. There's also an intent language there. Does that ever prohibit you from being able to carry forward?
I don't understand.
There's a, I think there is a standard that they have to knowingly present you with a check.
I think that that's more on the fraud issue.
On the fraud side.
The criminal intent on fraud.
Is the standard any different, is the monetary level any higher or lower? Or do you know? Not that I expect you to know. I just thought maybe you knew offhand.
Yeah. Well, when we have had awfully large checks that are clearly written fraudulently and clearly are a criminal case, our chances of collection are so low. If there is criminal action and if there is restitution that is awarded through those court cases, we may receive 10 cents on the dollar 8 years from now.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Jill? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to I think part of the problem of the 40% bad checks is that the financial institutions only allow you to present the check twice, I believe, and then after that, they will not accept you trying to redeposit that check. Is that the experience that you have with your financial institution?
Yes, yes. Although after that second time, you can physically go to the bank if the funds are available and collect a cashier's check. Although that has been it's very, very costly.
So I wonder if the sponsor has considered looking at that angle and upping the amount of times that an individual can present the check to a financial institution. It seems as though I know many, many people that aren't in the business get a check and try to do that, and the hassles that they receive from a financial institution, it seems as though someone should at least be able to present their checks three times to financial institutions without having to go and get a cashier's check and stand in line and do all of that paperwork or whatever.
I think what you would run into a large problem with that is the financial institutes are now charging $30 or more each time that check is submitted to their account and the funds are not there. So you would have your constituents with a situation where they would be charged close to $100 if it didn't clear on that third time.
And I understand that, and that's why I think that would be a financial incentive for people to not process bad checks.
Except for if they're processing bad checks, they don't seem to have, well, that doesn't seem to be their biggest concern, is what the bank is charging them. It gets them further in the hole and in a worse situation and less likely that a business can collect with a cashier's check. Although if they are writing checks knowingly without money in there, it would help with the 15% that write by accident.
Would you repeat the last sentence?
I think that it would help people that are in that 15% bracket that actually write a check on accident. They write it the day before their direct deposit, or they think that the transfer that they're going to make is going to be done in a little bit more timely fashion. It would perhaps help them, although that percentage usually clears the second time through.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. When you're talking about the fee that the bank charges, you're talking about the bank charging a fee to the person who has signed the check?
Yes.
Yeah, not to you as a person trying to cash the check.
No, there is a charge that our bank charges us when those items come back. They will debit our account the amount of the check plus a fee. It's not as high as the fee to the person who has written the check, but there is a fee that businesses experience when those checks come back.
So you would likewise be penalized if you ran it through a number of times?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions for Jill? Also online is Scott King, Cornerstone. Scott, are you available?
Yes, I am.
Would you introduce yourself and give who you represent, please?
Chairman Graham and members of the Senate Finance Committee, my name is Scott King. I'm Cornerstone Credit Services here in Anchorage, Alaska. I am testifying today in support of SB 299. The reason we feel this legislation is necessary is because of the recent district court decision in Fairbanks that will require significant change in the way we do business in collecting on bad checks. The decision would require the business to document and account for all costs incurred in attempting to collect on a bad check up to the maximum of $25, as the fee now currently supports. Historically, our state has interpreted it as allowing, or allowing, the maximum fee of $25 that businesses are allowed to collect to help repay for the costs of collecting on a bad check. Those costs typically include bank fees for the merchants, personnel costs, letters, telephone calls, accounting, documentation, or fees that they pay collection agencies such as myself to collect on the bad checks, as well as check verification costs. The effect of the decision would further require businesses to keep track of each of these expenses incurred, and they would be permitted to assess on the bad check only amount that they track and kept track of. SB 299, I think, would make two simple changes that we're looking for here today, is to change 0968115. I think first and foremost, the most important thing is to eliminate the words "for costs incurred" from our statute, so that it's clear that the bad check fee is an amount that business is entitled to collect for the harm incurred by the bad check. The second is to raise it to $25 to $30 to bring it more in line with what other states, and to compensate for the inflation, as our, I think, our $25 fee. I've been doing this for 18 years, and I have yet to see it be increased. Cornerstone has over 2,000 businesses clients in Alaska, which are directly affected by the court decision. We are one of the main collection agencies that provide both check verification and check collections to these businesses who do not handle the problem on their own. Businesses who choose to collect bad checks themselves are equally affected by this and will be burdened similarly. Many letters here from Alaska businesses, and we still expect to receive many more. I would like to thank the chairman and the committee for taking the time to consider this legislation and urge your support. I'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Scott. Are there questions for Scott? Thank you very much. Pamela Bowl, here in the room, wishes to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pamela LeBoll, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, and we are in support of Senate Bill 299. Our members have had the experience of costs being greater than the $25 or even the $30 in the collection of a check, but the court decision that has been referenced here that brings about the necessity for the change in this law has a great impact on our members, and we would appreciate the committee's support of this legislation.
Are there any of the other issues surrounding the bad check agenda that your members mentioned or that they have problems with?
Madam Chairman, no, there hasn't been.
Any questions for Pam? Okay, we could use one. Is there any further comment on Senate Bill 299? Jane, did you have anything else you wanted to add from what you've heard?
No, I do have a document here that does list some of the fees that banks charge, and it looks like they range anywhere from $2 to as high as $25, and you may not have that in your packets.
Okay. Very good. You might want to add that as it goes through the rest of the process, just for information. That is good information to know. Because we forget how that kind of tends to add up and then gets exponential as the time goes on. I have no objection to this passing out of the committee. If someone would like to move the bill, and we'll pass it on for further review by the full Senate.
Madam Chair, if I may have the honor of suggesting that we move Senate Bill 299 from finance with attached zero fiscal note individual recommendation.
There being no objection, Senate Bill 299 is moved from committee. Are there any announcements about this, anything on this week? Tomorrow, on March 2nd, we'll begin overviews of the capital project request, and go from there. We will be sure to have a full week. And again, Senate Bill 203 will be back before us when we have the information we've asked for. So anything else for the good of the order? Not Senate Finance is adjourned.